Right. With that, I will call this remote hearing of the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee to order. It is, this is Thursday, March 24th, 2022, and we are holding this hearing remotely per Rule 10.01. To start, it looks like we have a quorum, but we'll go ahead with the roll. Michaela, please take the roll.
Becker Finn?
Present.
Mueller?
Present.
Scott? Representative Scott?
Present.
Feist?
Present.
Frazier?
Present.
Grossel?
Present.
Herr?
Present.
Collins?
Present.
Johnson?
Present.
Liebling?
Present.
Long?
Present.
Mortensen?
Present.
Novotny?
Present.
Barr?
Or present.
Robbins?
Present.
Fang?
Present.
Zhang?
Present.
All right, a quorum is present. First item on the agenda is the minutes. Representative Wong, do I have a motion to approve the minutes for March 22nd, 2022?
So moved, Madam Chair.
All right, any discussion to the minutes? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? All right, the minutes are approved. Another busy day, but we're all going to be respectful of each other's time and stay focused today. Representative Long, the first bill on the agenda is House File 1152. Would you like to move the bill before us?
Yes, Madam Chair, that's my motion.
All right. The bill's now before us. I understand you have an A3 author's amendment. Would you like to move that and tell us briefly what it does?
I'd be happy to, Madam Chair. So the A3 amendment addresses an issue that Representative Grossel brought to my attention in the Public Safety Committee, which is that we have removed felonies from the scope of the Clean Slate Act, but we had not moved stays of adjudication for felony crimes. And so this would correct that and would remove stays of adjudication for felony from eligibility.
All right, committee process at work. Any discussion to the A3 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Representative Long, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. The Clean Slate Act that we're hearing today has a simple premise. We should give those who have paid their debt to society an opportunity for redemption. Too often, having a criminal record severely limits an individual's opportunities to find jobs, housing, or education. I have personally heard moving stories from constituents who have worked hard to overcome their past and who are trying very hard to get jobs or to get housing, but for whom their criminal record has become a real barrier to those opportunities and to moving forward with their life. 1 in 4 Minnesotans have some type of criminal record, and 90% of employers conduct background checks. So if you put these two numbers together, that adds up to a really significant barrier to employment for tens of thousands of Minnesotans. The bill we're hearing today is similar to broad bipartisan efforts we've seen in recent years in states like Utah, Pennsylvania, and Michigan. In Utah, their Clean Slate Act bill passed unanimously. In Pennsylvania, it passed by a vote of 181-2. In Michigan, after they implemented the bill, those who have had their records expunged have seen their average wages increase by 25%. This bill also builds on the leadership many of our county attorneys are currently showing in expunging old records. Prosecutors right now can initiate expungements, and many have done so for old misdemeanors like these. But this has been focused primarily in the metro counties where there are more resources in our county attorney offices. And so there have been regional inequities in their ability across the state to pursue these types of relief for individuals. The County Attorneys Association has been a really terrific partner in this effort. Several county attorneys spent many, many hours on a working group helping us put this bill together. And I just wanted to thank them for all their efforts over several years to get to this point. So the Clean Slate Act would automatically expunge records for certain misdemeanors after a crime-free waiting period. It excludes any enhanceable offense, any person offenses, any criminal sexual conduct offenses. And one big change, as I mentioned, that we made from last year's bill is we removed the list of eligible felonies. The bill contains important protections, including allowing continued law enforcement access to records. It also allows DHS access to records for sensitive employment background checks, so that would not change from current law. I'm really grateful for the bipartisan support this bill has received. We've made many changes along the way to try to build support. My Senate co-author is Senator Chamberlain, and in the House, Representatives Hertas and Garofalo are co-authors. In our last stop in public safety, I was enormously gratified for the 17-1 vote we had in favor, and I'm very much hoping that with the amendment today, I've addressed Representative Grossel's remaining concern with the bill. I also wanted to note that there is broad organizational support for the bill. There's a letter of support, I think, that was submitted to the committee from Violence Free Minnesota and Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault from victim organizations. It's also supported by the Catholic Conference and Americans for Prosperity, to name a couple others. So in sum, this bill is an opportunity for rehabilitation, for better economic opportunities, which we know reduces recidivism and helps people reintegrate into society. It's about offering hope and second chances. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to the four testifiers we have, Madam Chair.
All right. With that, we'll move on to the testifiers. First on the list is Bob Small. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. My name is Robert Small, and I am the Executive Director for the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. Thank you for allowing me to testify on the Clean Slate Act as amended. Our association supports this legislation, and we thank Representative Long for authoring this bill and for including the county attorney in the many discussions that led up to this bill. So I'd be happy to stand for questions. That's all I have, Madam Chair.
Short and sweet. Appreciate it, Mr. Small. Next on the list, I have Chaz Anderson. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Becker-Finn and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony today on House File 1152. For the record, my name is Chaz Anderson, and I'm here representing the Justice Action Network. The Justice Action Network is the nation's largest bipartisan criminal justice organization, working at the federal level and in over 20 states, including Minnesota, since 2016. During the past legislative interim, Representative Long worked with stakeholders to resolve some outstanding issues that were brought up during the 2021 legislative session, including the work of automating records. Stepping back, we looked at the lessons learned in early adopter states of Pennsylvania and Utah. Both of those states worked on ensuring there was a workable process in place to automate the expungements and started out with lower level offenses first. And that's the approach in the current version of House File 1152. The legislation scales back the number of offenses eligible for automatic expungement. For example, felonies are no longer eligible, and a number of misdemeanors and gross misdemeanor offenses are not eligible in this new language. The author and the stakeholders worked with the BCA to ensure that the agency has a process in place to manage the data and complete the automatic expungements with integrity. We have also a number of employer and public safety protections in the bill, as we've outlined in a background document distributed to the committee. One of the protections includes the ability for law enforcement agencies to access expunged record data at any point in time. Lastly, research shows that the cumbersome petition-based systems fail to provide the relief as they intended. A 2019 study in Michigan found that just 6.5% of eligible people obtained expungements within 5 years of eligibility. To address the shortcomings, at least five states have enacted automatic expungement systems, including Pennsylvania, Utah, Michigan, Connecticut, and Delaware, and many other states like Minnesota are considering legislation this year. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you for your testimony. Next on the list, I have Marcel Hopker. If you can introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Hello, I am Marcel Hopker. I'm the owner of Strive Staffing here in Minneapolis. I see this bill as a good step to help people that I have to run through background checks and misdemeanors come up, and then I have to explain those. Often a person will come in and I'll have to run them through a background check for another company that I'm placing them with. And that company's background check will bring up everything. And the hesitation at seeing misdemeanors and not a pattern of them really becomes an issue. And in today's day of hiring, any background knock is pretty difficult to get past, which is unfortunate because every company is short people. And as you said, one out of four people have a criminal record, and it makes it very difficult. I've come out of the DOC. I have a criminal record, and I've experienced how difficult it is. I do also know that we can get past it. So with that, thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Last, I have Jonathan Weinhagen. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jonathan Weinhagen. I'm the President and CEO of the Minneapolis Regional Chamber, here to testify in support of House File 1152, the Clean Slate Act. As an organization representing nearly 2,300 businesses across the greater metropolitan region, we know the importance of having a trained and skilled workforce, particularly given the shortages that you've heard about this morning, and believe that this legislation will help be a part of filling that void. Unfortunately, there are so many barriers for individuals with criminal records who seek to better their lives and face barriers in education, housing, and employment. We know that according to the Brennan Center, the number of Americans with a criminal history has increased. You've heard that one in four number this morning. And today our country has roughly as many people with a criminal background as we do individuals with a college education. These numbers do not include people who were arrested but never charged or those who have been acquitted. As we think about the workforce over the course of the next decade, employers are going to need skilled and educated workers. And we'll continue to have a shortage even in a post-COVID world that I believe is on the horizon and I think we all aspire to. And this bill certainly will allow a pathway for individuals to receive that expungement for certain convictions while maintaining the access that we know is necessary for our public safety organizations. It'll also make an enormous difference for individuals who are seeking enrollment in post-secondary education opportunities, training programs to receive occupational licenses and secure stable housing. And we believe that the Clean Slate Act is a win for Minnesota's workforce and economy, and really appreciate the opportunity to share that perspective with all of you this morning.
All right, thank you everyone for your testimony. That wraps up what we've got on the list. So we'll move on to member discussion. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have a question. The bill lists out all these crimes that will be expunged, but which ones aren't expungible? If the author could kind of elaborate on that a little bit more. Did I reverse that? I need to reverse that.
I think he knows what you're asking.
Thank you.
Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the question, Representative Scott. So, yes, the list of crimes in the bill are those that are not expungible. And it's basically three categories. It's those that are enhanceable. So where down the road there you could use a prior conviction to enhance the penalty later. We don't want to expunge those so that courts still have the access to that data from the past. And then it includes any criminal sexual conduct cases. I think that's one of the reasons why we also saw support from Violence Free Minnesota and from MnCASA. And then it includes any person crimes. So, you know, any crime of violence or interpersonal crime, assault, things like that. So what's left are really what we would consider low-level misdemeanor offenses. And those are the ones that the county attorneys have also been targeting in their work to do some of the county attorney prosecutor-initiated expungements.
Follow-up, Representative Scott.
No, Madam Chair, thank you.
All right, Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker Finn, Representative Long.
This is not easy.
I was looking through the bill, and I appreciate what you're trying to do, and I think with this latest amendment, it's helped quite a bit. It makes it more easier to support. But I found an issue I have concerns with last night, and I didn't get a chance to contact you. One thing that could cause some little bit of havoc, I think could cause some havoc too, is some of the misdemeanor drug offenses in Chapter 172 that are going to be expunged. I'm just wondering if that's, and I have concerns, that it's going to affect our permit to carry holders in other states. With the agreements we have with our permit to carry in other states, if we are allowing offenses that disqualify people to possess a firearm and they end up in other states with a permit to carry, they could cancel our agreements in other states. That's why I have some concerns. I think it's something that needs to be looked into.
Representative Wong, any response?
Thank you, Chair Beckerfin. Thank you for the question, Representative Johnson. That's the first time that question's come up, so I don't have a good answer for you, unfortunately, but I would be more than happy to work with you offline and see if we can address that. I think the motion will be to go to Ways and Means, and so this won't be our final stop. And if there's something that we need to fix with the bill in that regard, you have my commitment to do that, as I did for Representative Grossel and the issue he raised in public safety.
And Representative Wong, I actually have a question just so we kind of have this on the record for people's understanding with this bill. So these are crimes that people could have expunged if they went through the whole process to get expunged. We're just making it automatic. It's not like we're making something expungible that wasn't expungible previously, correct?
Chair Beckerfin, that's correct. And it's actually a smaller list than those that are petition eligible for expungement. There are some felonies, for example, or some gross misdemeanors that we're not making automatically expungible. And the automatic expungement is also not for all folks, because there's a waiting period where you have to be crime free. So there's additional hurdles in the bill besides those that are in the petition process.
Representative Johnson, do you still have questions?
I just want to make a brief comment. I appreciate Representative Long's consideration to work on this and look into it. So I will be supporting it for now, but it's something that we definitely need to look into, because I don't want issues with our law-abiding citizens have trouble in other states.
All right. Not seeing any other hands. Representative Long, and as you just noted, I think the motion will be that this goes to Ways and Means, and I do recognize that the fiscal note will change because of the changes that have been made in the various amendments. So that's we can figure that out in Ways, but given that it's our deadlines are quickly approaching, we're going to move it to Ways. So would you like to move House File 1152 be referred to the Ways and Means Committee?
Yes, Madam Chair, I would like to make that motion.
All right. And then any closing comments to the bill?
I'll just thank Representative Johnson for raising that issue, and you have my commitment to look into that between now and Ways and Means. The fiscal note isn't back yet, but we expect it to be greatly reduced from last year's fiscal note. And that's because, as Ms. Anderson mentioned, we've spent a lot of time working with BCA to try to get this process right. And removing felonies as well is going to reduce the cost substantially. So hopefully, if members were looking at the old fiscal note, that's a lot higher than I think it's going to be when it comes back. So I just want to thank the coalition of supporters who've worked on this for many years and brought us to this point, and I would certainly ask for member support.
All right. Sounds good. I also appreciate an updated fiscal note. With that, Representative Long renews his motion that House File 1152 as amended be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Beckerfin?
Aye.
Muller?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
Feist?
Aye.
Frazier?
Aye.
Grossel?
Aye.
Herr?
Aye.
Collins?
Aye.
Johnson?
Johnson, aye.
Liebling?
Aye.
Long?
Aye.
Mortensen?
Aye.
Zavotny?
Aye.
Farr?
Farr, aye.
Robbins?
Aye.
Fang?
Aye.
Zhang?
Aye.
That is 17 ayes and 0 nays.
All right. The motion prevails and the bill is referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Thank you to our testifiers and thank you, Representative Long, for working on this with members to get it right. Really a testament to how the committee process is supposed to work. Appreciate that. I'm going to move on to the next bill. The next bill up, we have House File 3162. It is a Representative Freiberg bill. I will move House File 3162 be referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. I also know that we have a DE2 amendment, so I will go ahead and move the DE2. The DE2 gets the bill in the shape the author would like. Any discussion to the DE2? All right. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? All right, the motion prevails and the DE2 is adopted. Representative Freiberg, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. So as sovereign governments, tribes like White Earth and Red Lake can create their own medical cannabis programs that operate within the borders of their lands, but there can be complications. For example, a tribal member enrolled in a tribal medical cannabis program who leaves the boundaries of a reservation can be charged with possession under Minnesota law. Passing House File 3162 will give patients registered with tribal medical cannabis programs, as well as the programs themselves, assurance that they will not run into problems with Minnesota laws. This has been discussed in Health, Finance, and Policy since last year, and we've continued to have discussions between MDH, the tribes, and other stakeholders. This bill spells out how a tribal medical cannabis program will operate when Minnesota laws apply. It also makes it clear that tribal medical cannabis programs can transport medical cannabis to testing laboratories within Minnesota under specified conditions. I have several tribal representatives here, and it's probably more important to hear from them, so I will keep my comments brief. But in short, I hope committee members will support this bill, and I would like to turn it over to my testifiers.
All right. Thank you. And I had to flip a coin to see which chairman gets to go first. But I see that Chairman Fairbanks has his camera on. So we will go to Chairman Michael Fairbanks from White Earth Nation. Please introduce yourself for the record. Welcome to the committee and go ahead with your testimony, Mr. Chairman.
Ani Bujou, Madam Chair, and also members of the committee. You know, I want to say miigwech for your time today and your patience with us. And, you know, I know here back in White Earth, or I'm not in White Earth, but you know, back in 2020, we had a referendum during this past election in 2020, and our people voted 90% to have a medical cannabis program. So that's one part of the back in White Earth that we've done for our program. And, you know, I know that this program is going to be a great program, not only for our members of White Earth, but also the citizens of Minnesota. And, you know, hopefully that, you know, the main thing that we've talked about since we went down this path is our partnership with the state of Minnesota. So hopefully that, you know, that we can keep moving forward with this. And, you know, and I got Lenny here with me. I'm on his laptop, and I'll defer all the questions to him, and he'll explain what we have going on. So I want to say miigwech, and thanks, everyone.
Yeah, thank you very much. Lenny, before we go to you, I want to give our chairman the first time. So we're going to go to the chairman from Red Lake Nation. I think he may be on the phone, but it looks like he's unmuted. Please go ahead and introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, can you guys hear me?
Yep, loud and clear, Mr. Chairman. Please go ahead.
Hey, my name is Daryl G. Siki, Senior Chairman of Red Lake Nation. I want to say Ani Bujou Kinema Yai. So in our basin, the Madam Chair, Jamie Becker Finn, and committee members, on HF 3162, the Red Lake Nation developed its medical cannabis program after being informed that Red Lake members overwhelmingly support this medical option. Through an advisory vote, 83% of the Red Lake tribal members affirmed their support for the tribe's development of its own medical cannabis program. In response to the tribal member vote, the Red Lake Nation has enacted its own medical cannabis regulatory system, and we have developed our own state-of-the-art facility for manufacturing medical cannabis. Because of our unique status in Indian country as a closed reservation, the Red Lake Nation has full civil and criminal jurisdiction over all matters on the Red Lake Reservation, including the ability to fill medical cannabis prescriptions for residents and non-residents of the reservation. Red Lake does not desire to operate in the state's existing medical cannabis regulatory framework. Instead, the tribe supports changes to the state's existing medical cannabis laws, which clarify the tribe's ability to provide medical cannabis to Red Lake members and to other Minnesota citizens who chose to fill their prescriptions through the Red Lake program. We want to assure that patients of Red Lake Dispensary are not subject to a double standard when they have their prescribed medical cannabis in their position while off the reservation. The Red Lake Nation will participate in the medical cannabis marketplace in Minnesota in a responsible manner, and we will share our experiences with the state medical cannabis regulators. Our goal is to maximize consumer protection, safety, security, accountability, and convenience for patients. Our procedures for manufacturing medical cannabis products prioritize the conservation of natural resources, including water, as well as protection against the adverse environmental impact. All medical cannabis products manufactured at Red Lake will be laboratory tested and subject to quality control measures to ensure safety for human consumption. We are seeking the ability to transport medical cannabis product to off-reservation testing facilities so that we may assure that our quality control standards are met. Because of the economic development potential of medical cannabis manufactured, particularly in Indian country, we are requesting that the legislator again prioritize the production of local homegrown medical cannabis to supply the market, the Minnesota market. As you are aware, the two original licenses of the state medical cannabis program have sold out to out-of-state companies. The Red Lake Nation is not going anywhere. We will be able to assure that the product we produce is homegrown, as was originally intended of the two state licensed entities. Miigwech, allow me to testify. Miigwech.
Miigwech, Mr. Chairman, any day we get to hear Ojibwe Mo in committee is a good day. So I'm slowly learning. I could only catch some of the words, but really appreciate your testimony here this morning. Both of our chairmen, it's not lost on me that you're taking time out of your busy days as chairman of your nations to be with us this morning. So Chi Miigwech to both of you. We do have two more testifiers. So now I'll go to Lenny Finde from White Earth. Lenny, please introduce yourself for the committee and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chairwoman and members of the committee. My name is Lenny Finde, and I serve as the general counsel for the White Earth Nation. And I'm here to testify on behalf of House File 3162. In order to not be repetitive, I just want to thank, first of all, Chairman Siki for his very good testimony and the overview of the bill and what we're trying to accomplish. And I just want to assure the members of the committee that I am here to answer questions. We do have an amendment that we're requesting approval on today, and that amendment is based off of conversations that the tribes are continuing to have on an ongoing basis with representatives from the Office of Medical Cannabis and the Minnesota Department of Health, and some of the limitations that they have within their software and the systems that they use. And so that's what's going to sort of change the dual registration that we initially had in the bill. But the ultimate goal for both of those, and I think is important for this committee, was number one, to ensure that tribal members who are patients in our regulated medical cannabis programs on the reservation, if they're traveling off the reservation to visit family in the Twin Cities or Moorhead or Bemidji or Duluth, that they would be able to take their prescription with them and use it while they're visiting their family members and have the same immunity to civil and criminal prosecution for possession as those patients in the state system have. And then the second thing that we're seeking is to ensure that our patients who are traveling off the reservation and maybe close to a state dispensary would be allowed to purchase from a state dispensary, and those patients enrolled in the state's program would be able to purchase from the tribal dispensary. So it's sort of like a seamless program operation is what we're seeking. And I do appreciate the approach of both Red Lake and White Earth leadership. And I do want to say real quickly that Red Lake and White Earth are the only two of the 11 federally recognized tribes in the state right now that are moving forward with a medical cannabis program. But we do anticipate other tribes will move into the industry as it becomes clear the boundaries of jurisdiction. And so that's one of the things that this bill accomplishes. It ensures that, the state program and the tribal programs are working together as much as possible in collaboration, that there's transparency and consistency among the programs. And the final thing that I want to mention is with regard to transportation of cannabis products. Right now, Minnesota law only allows the two licensees under the Minnesota program to transport their product on state highways. We're seeking permission to transport regulated tribal cannabis program products to primarily the testing lab in St. Paul, and that is to ensure that the product that is produced by the tribal programs are at the same rigorous testing standard as those that are produced by the state's licensees. And so that tests for a number of things like heavy metals and pesticides, just to ensure that the product that's coming out of the program is a quality medical grade product that meets all the requirements necessary. The other thing is the fiscal, the amendments today will substantially reduce the fiscal note that's on the bill because as it was drafted, there would be changes that MDH would have been required to make. But with this amendment, that will undo a lot, or MDH won't have to do those changes to their software, and so that will drastically reduce the fiscal note. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Finde. Last on the list, I have Joe Plummer. Mr. Plummer, if you want to introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Yes. Morning, Chair Becker-Finn and committee members. My name is Joe Plummer. I serve as General Legal Counsel for the Red Lake Band of Chippewa, and I echo everything that the speakers before me stated. I get to play cleanup. What we're seeking, is to be able to operate our tribal medical cannabis programs in peace, for the tribal program regulators and also for the patients, so that it just treated the same way as regular patients through the state's medical cannabis program. And I think that the amendments that we fine-tuned through regular contact with the governor's office as well as the Department of Health satisfies our concerns and will get us to where we are. Just one thing I wanted to say, Chair and committee members, is that this law is what's known as a civil regulatory law. And what that means is the state permits medical cannabis through licensing to dispensaries right now. And so that means it's, and regulates it. So that means it's fair game for the tribes to operate their own. And we just want to be able to operate those seamlessly, with the state program. And we've been approached by many different people that are, very excited about moving forward with this. We've been very responsible. We're not jumping into anything. And we waited for the state medical cannabis and flower form to roll out on March 1st before we decided, to go forward with that same method. So if there's any questions that anybody has, I'm all ears.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for your testimony. We also have someone from the Department of Health available for questions. However, I will just remind members that the issue before us here in judiciary are the provisions regarding civil protections and penalties, as well as non-discrimination found in Section 9. So we're going to limit our discussion here in judiciary and civil law to those provisions. And then just a reminder that this bill is going to the Health Committee next. So we will move on to member discussion. Representative Grossel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And hold on camera. Hold on a second. Sorry. Okay. There we go. I just want to understand, are all of the tribes already able to get medical cannabis in through the state program without any issues of getting themselves in trouble when transporting it? Or Mr. Representative Freiber, can you help me wrap my head around that?
I'm guessing since Mr. Finde turned on his camera that maybe he's the one best suited to answer that. All right. Mr. Finde.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Grossel. Yes. So right now, as Mr. Plummer had explained, right now, the way that it is the tribes have the inherent authority to operate or regulate this conduct within the boundaries of their reservations. And so what we're seeking to do with this bill is to ensure that there's seamless jurisdiction, whether you're on the reservation or off the reservation. So as it stands right now, yes, tribal members can participate in the state's program. However, what we found in surveying our tribal members, and again, I'm only speaking for White Earth right now, but what we found in surveying our tribal members is that there were a number of barriers for them to access the state's program, including the cost of product as well as transportation to and from the various state dispensaries. And so that's where we're seeking to regulate that conduct on the reservation for our members. But then again, understanding that there are members that do travel off the reservation. And so that's where this bill comes into play. And I hope that answers your question.
Representative Grossel, and just remember, we're trying not to get into every single detail of the bill, but a lot of the members from both of these nations, want to give you the ability to ask a question, but follow up, Representative Grossel.
Yeah, I mean, I just wanted to get that clear in my head as to just what they're trying to, what's trying to be done here to make sure that they have access and can move about without getting themselves in trouble. So I just wanted to understand that. So thank you. That's all I had.
All right. Not seeing any other hands up. Representative Freiberg, closing comments on your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is a really important subject and shows respect to our sovereign governments located within Minnesota. So I would encourage members to vote yes.
All right. And Chimigwich, again, to our tribal dignitaries joining us here this morning. Really appreciate you taking the time to speak to our committee today. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 3162, as amended, be referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Beckerfin?
Aye.
Mueller?
Aye.
Scott? Representative Scott? Feist?
Aye.
Frazier?
Aye.
Grossel?
Aye.
Herr?
Aye.
Collins?
Aye.
Johnson?
Aye.
Liebling?
Aye.
Long?
Aye.
Mortensen?
Aye.
Novotny?
No.
Barr?
Barr, aye.
Robbins?
Aye.
Aye.
Bang?
Aye.
Sean?
Aye.
That is 15 ayes and 1 nay.
All right. The motion prevails. The bill is referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Thank you, Representative Freiberg, and our testifiers. Moving right along, we've got House File 4430, a Representative Schultz bill. I will move House File 4430 be referred to the Commerce Committee. No amendments. Representative Schultz, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn. Great to be back in this committee. I want to thank members for taking the time to hear this bill. I know how busy you are. First, I want to thank nonpartisan House research staffer Randy Chun in helping me draft this bill. It's a pretty large bill, pretty complicated, and I know how busy the HHS staff are this time of year, so I want to thank him. But what House File 4430 does, it's a bill that establishes an entity called the Health Affordability Board, and it also creates a Health Affordability Advisory Council. So it brings stakeholders together to look at and evaluate our healthcare costs in the state, across the state, and use that information to try to compare our costs with other states and try to work with providers in addressing the cost growth. And there's 9 states that are already implementing something similar, and 1 is pending in another state. And Representative Schumacher and Senator Benson have a bill that they introduced last year. It's House File 1612 in the House, that also tries to look at healthcare costs and compare them to other states. And this has much more detailed information and much more structure. But I am working with the stakeholders, the payers, and the integrated healthcare systems on the language. And Representative Schumacher is reviewing the language as well. So what the intent is to, over time, get a control over the very large percentage increase in healthcare costs. And the Milbank Memorial Fund is working with states on creating these health policy commissions or health affordability boards. And that's a nonpartisan group that's very dedicated to state-level reform. And I've been fortunate to be a Milbank fellow and really learning from other states as well. Massachusetts has had this the longest, and they have realized, they've been doing it since 2012, and they have saved over $9.3 billion over 7 years. So this is a huge savings by looking at what our costs are and working with providers. And I know this committee is concerned with the data practices areas and the civil penalty. So if providers go over this benchmark cost growth that this independent entity establishes, it's not set in the bill, they will be asked to look at a program improvement plan to become more efficient and submit a plan to the board. And if they don't, there's a penalty. So there's some teeth or enforcement to making sure that they are actually working hard to become more efficient and reduce the rate of cost growth over time. So I really want Minnesota to get on board with these other states and be a leader in this as well. So with that, I believe there could be a testifier, Chair Becker-Finn.
Yep, I've got one testifier on the list. So we'll move on to the testifier. Kenza Hodge Musa from Take Action, please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn and members. My name is Kenza Hodge Musa, and I'm the Public Affairs Director at Take Action Minnesota. We're a statewide multiracial membership organization. We strongly support House File 4430, creating a health affordability board. Take Action members have worked on healthcare issues for 15 years. We support the creation of a health affordability board because we believe everybody deserves the chance to live a good, healthy life and that our government is responsible for making healthcare work for everyone. Several years ago, our members told us we needed to focus on healthcare, especially prescription drug costs. Across the state, we've heard worries and horror stories from our members. We heard from Catherine, whose brother-in-law died rationing insulin alone at home. We heard from Cassandra, who chooses each month between rent and her medicine. We heard from Glenn, a graduate student whose life fell apart when they had to go off bipolar medicine that cost $700 a month. We heard from Kate, who has to choose between which son gets with life-threatening allergies, gets an EpiPen because they cost $1,500. And every year we hear from families spending thousands of dollars on healthcare that they and coverage that they can't afford to use. Out of control, healthcare costs affect all of us, from our public health insurance premiums to our collective public health. This board is one of the best tools we have for lowering overall healthcare spending. We strongly support the enforcement provision on page 10, starting at line 29, which allows the board to enforce performance improvement plans by leveling a $500,000 penalty in certain circumstances. We also strongly support establishing an Office of Patient Protection that's included in the bill. We urge you to vote yes. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. It was the only testifier, although I will note that we do have somebody from Department of Health available if there are questions that Representative Schultz can't answer. We'll move on to member discussion. Representative Scott.
Can you hear me, Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Scott.
Thank you. I had to switch over to my phone instead of the computer. I had a couple of questions to the bill's author. What type of unique or custom data sets is the board going to be requesting from state agencies on this?
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn. I will answer it, but I can also defer to Stefan Gildemeister if he has more complete information. We are collecting new information, hopefully in all payer claims database. That's a bill you also heard in this committee on value-based payment. So it could be that type of information, Representative Scott. It could be de-identified information from the all payer claims database. And so that's where we don't want to duplicate the payers and the plans and providers submitting additional data. We really want to limit the burden on the providers. And so we want to use as much existing data as we can. And this is direction from other states and what they're doing. So we're learning a lot from Massachusetts, and we looked at their legislation and how they modified it as well. And that's the language we used. But those are examples of types of data I think the independent board would seek out from the agencies.
Mr. Gildemeister, do you have anything to add? And if you do, please introduce yourself and then go ahead with your response.
Good morning, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Stefan Gildemeister. I direct the Health Economics Program in the Department of Health. And Representative Scott, to your question, Representative Schultz mentioned this is a complex bill and some decisions are delegated to bodies that this bill forms. So to an extent, we have to wait for these entities to shape the growth targets and the data that they wish to see. But to the point that Representative Schultz makes, there are a number of states out there who've done this work at various levels of complexity and detail. And seeing that healthcare is a field where data shape payments, quality measurement, and accountability, there is substantial data in the system, so to speak. Generally speaking, I would say healthcare claims data serve some of the needs of tracking healthcare spending. Similarly, payment data of the aggregated payment data will likely also be valuable to this process. Ultimately, the question really is, which entities are accountable for these spending growth targets? Are they just health plans or payers, or are they payers and providers? At which level of provider system would this be? That would ultimately determine which data were necessary. As I started out saying, my sense is there is much data in the system that we already either collect or use, and at best, I would expect they would have to be fine-tuned to the choices the board wishes to make. Ultimately, there's also a trade-off, and maybe the board under this bill might decide to change the design of the growth targets based on available data. So I think one has to see. I'm sorry if that is a not very precise answer to your question.
All right, thank you. Follow-up, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I don't see why we can't collect this data without a board. I think the legislature is perfectly capable of collecting that data. And then my final question for the bill's author is, I don't see any reporting requirement in this bill. Will the board be putting out a report at the end of every year so that people can, there is a reporting requirement there. I thought I didn't see it in there. I was scanning through. All right. That's the end of my questions, Madam Chair.
Representative Schultz.
Of course. Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn and Representative Scott. I would never forget the reporting requirements. That's the most important piece, but I'm glad you also agree with me that that is very important. So this is a bill that really fits into a package of bills that I've been envisioning to get the state moving forward on really truly addressing healthcare costs, not just creating reinsurance, which we're going to debate on the floor tonight. That does nothing to provide incentives to address the cost growth. So I think this is a real solution, and other states are doing it. And I want to be in that group of other states so we can more responsibly spend state taxpayer dollars. And I, Representative Scott, I am really looking forward to working across the aisle and with you. This bill came in late because it took a long time to put together, but really eager to see what you like about the bill, to talk about your concerns, and maybe we can chat on the floor tonight. But thank you, members, for hearing the bill. I really appreciate your time.
All right. Thank you, Representative Schultz. Kind of seemed like that was your closing in response. So you're nodding. Appreciate another chair who understands how many bills we got to get through. So with that, I will renew my motion that House File 4430 be referred to the Commerce Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Becker-Finn?
Aye.
Mueller?
Aye.
Scott?
No.
Feist?
Aye.
Frazier?
Aye.
Grossel?
No.
Herr?
Aye.
Hollins?
Aye.
Johnson?
No.
Liebling?
Aye.
Long?
Aye.
Mortensen?
Mortensen, no.
Novotny?
Novotny, no.
Farr?
Farr, no.
Robbins?
No.
Bang?
Aye.
Zhang? Representative Zhang? That is 10 ayes and 7 nays.
All right, with 10 ayes and 7 nays, the motion prevails and the bill is referred to the Commerce Committee. Thank you, Representative Schultz and testifiers. Moving right along, we've got House File 778, a Representative Stevenson bill. I will move House File 778 be referred to the Tax Committee. Understand there is a DE4, so I will then move the DE4 amendment. Any discussion to the DE4? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? All right. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Stevenson, please tell us about your bill as amended, keeping in mind this is the Judiciary Committee and it is a very long bill and we are not going to get into every section of the bill. But if you can tell us about your bill, we would appreciate it. Thank you, Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. And I'll give a brief overview of the entire bill and then speak to the specifics in the Judiciary Committee's jurisdiction. The bill legalizes sports betting in Minnesota. Let's be clear from the outset that sports betting is already happening in Minnesota. We have a robust black market here with estimates of over $2 billion in black market activity. People just use shady websites, digital workarounds, and other means to place bets. What this bill is about is creating a legal marketplace that will displace the black market, and in doing so, provide consumer protection, ensure the integrity of the game, and limit money laundering and other illegal activity. In 2018, the Supreme Court struck down longstanding federal law prohibiting sports betting in states other than Nevada and New Jersey. Since then, over 30 states have legalized sports betting. All of Minnesota's neighboring states, including Canada, have legal sports betting. This is an idea whose time has come. Having said that, it's important to get this right. This is the biggest change to our state's gambling laws in 40 years. And so during the interim, I engaged with every stakeholder I could. I traveled the state. From the Red Lake Nation in northwestern Minnesota to sports data companies located in downtown Minneapolis, listening and trying to develop a Minnesota-specific model for legal sports betting. During that process, I consulted with all 11 of the tribal nations located across Minnesota, along with our professional sports teams, the University of Minnesota, sports betting companies, and experts on problem gaming. I also examine the law in other states that have legal sports betting, and
you are not anymore.
To Iowa. The product of all of this work is the bill that's before you today. This bill includes both brick-and-mortar sports betting at tribal casinos as well as statewide mobile sports betting operated by the tribes in partnership with commercial operators. To put that in plain terms, if this bill passes, Minnesotans will be able to visit sports betting lounges at casinos all across Minnesota, and they'll also be able to wager on sports on their smartphones anywhere in the state. We would tax mobile sports betting at levels consistent or below states around the country. The money generated from this tax would be dedicated to three causes. First, the regulations and consumer protections necessary to make sure that sports betting is fair and doesn't influence what's happening on the field, particularly at the amateur level. Second, we devote 40% of the tax revenue generated to addressing and treating problem gaming. We need to be honest. Most people can gamble without issue, but for a small subset, it's a real problem. We would devote more resources than ever before to confronting this problem. Finally, 40% of the tax revenue raised would go to funding youth sports and other youth programming across the state, with particular emphasis on communities experiencing a high level of juvenile crime. Juvenile crime is at unacceptable levels in Minnesota, and while there's no single cause or one single solution, we know that when kids are busy playing sports, they're not getting into trouble doing something else. It's taken a lot of work to get the bill to this point, and there's still a lot of work to be done. Members from both parties have come to me with ideas about how to improve the bill, and we've included many of those ideas. I'm very open to including more. We have a couple more committee stops in front of us, and so I encourage members to keep those ideas coming and keep the bill moving. This committee certainly has jurisdiction over the data provisions in the bill, in particular located in Section 20 of Article 1, starting on page 23. There's also some civil penalties in the bill. And I believe, Madam Chair, that I have covered everything. I'm happy to answer questions at the appropriate time.
All right. Thank you for that intro. We do have several testifiers, so we want to get to testimony. We'll remind our testifiers that we need to keep your testimony to 2 minutes out of respect for everybody else. First on the list, I have Sam Kruger. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sam Kruger, and I'm the Executive Director of the Electronic Gaming Group. We are a trade association that represents licensed charitable organizations that operate electronic games, e-game distributors, manufacturers, and others in the e-gaming industry. I am here today to express my organization's strong concerns with this bill. To be clear, we are not opposed to sports betting in general, but we are against bills that will allow our chief competitor, the tribes, to vastly expand their operations outside of their existing jurisdictions without offering the charities a reasonable path to compete and grow going forward. It has been said again and again, whether by the author of this bill or in the media headlines, that this puts the tribes in charge of sports betting. They have been called the experts in the gaming arena, while people make almost no mention of the nearly $3 billion industry that is charitable gambling. Charitable gambling is done in thousands of locations across the state and in every single one of your districts. It is already done on Wi-Fi connected handheld devices that are linked to servers and networks. So I'm here today to say that the charities are also experts in gaming, and we deserve a seat at the table. This bill would be much more palatable to the charities of our state if it included protections for our existing games, as well as allowing us new ways to draw in customers to compete for our state's finite entertainment dollars. Additionally, if the tribes are going to be allowed mobile gaming, it only makes sense that the charities would at least be able to offer destination-based mobile gambling as well. Furthermore, before the legislature hands the tribes yet another form of tax-free gaming, we strongly urge the body to consider the proposal of our friends at Allied Charities of Minnesota and reduce the extreme tax burden on the charities of our state. Thank you.
All right, moving right along, I have Andy Plato. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Andy Plato, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Indian Gaming Association, or MIGA. MIGA represents 10 of the 11 tribes in Minnesota and appreciates the ability to provide comments on House File 778, Chair Stevenson's bill to authorize sports wagering. Since the federal law prohibiting states from acting on sports wagering was overturned in 2018, Minnesota tribes and their leaders have closely watched as other states, including those surrounding Minnesota, have provided a legal marketplace for sports bettors. of particular importance has been the impact sports wagering has had on other tribal gaming operations, as gaming provides the economic lifeblood of tribal governments, tribal communities, and the tens of thousands of Minnesotans they employ. Upon review, in many cases, the impact of sports wagering expansion has been a positive one, but only when the authorizing legislation is carefully crafted to ensure that tribes play a critical role in bringing the marketplace to consumers. Tribal leaders, some of whom you've heard from earlier today, continue to review the proposed language and hope to soon be as comfortable with the details as they currently are with the general framework. But in concept, House File 778 does recognize that tribes, as the state's gaming experts, are best positioned to operate Minnesota's sports betting market, both in retail and mobile environments. For these reasons, I'm pleased to ask the committee to approve the bill today. MIGA and individual tribes will continue to offer their input in good faith as the bill moves through the process. Tribal leaders and staff would like to offer our thanks to Chair Stevenson for his respectful engagement on this issue and wish to continue our conversations with the legislature and other stakeholders to ensure any expansion of off-reservation gaming benefits both tribes and the Minnesota sports betting public. Madam Chair and members, thank you again for the ability to provide comments and for your willingness to consider tribal voices throughout this process. I stand ready to answer any questions you may have. Thank you.
All right, thank you for your testimony. Next on the list, I have Pat Gibbs. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony today related to authorizing and regulating mobile sports wagering in Minnesota. And thank you to Representative Stevenson and Garofalo for your continued willingness to work with my client and other stakeholders to create a sports wagering structure that works for Minnesota. My name is Pat Gibbs. I'm an attorney with the law firm Bork, Harrington, and Sutcliffe. And it is my pleasure to serve as National Public Policy Counsel for the Sports Betting Alliance, or SBA. The SBA is a trade organization comprised of many of the top operators in the mobile sports wagering industry, DraftKings, FanDuel, Bally's, BetMGM, and Fanatics. Together, our members advocate for competitive mobile sports wagering in the United States. And although I represent the SBA in state capitals across the country, I'm particularly pleased to advocate for bringing this industry to Minnesota because I grew up in Bloomington, graduated from Jefferson High School and the University of Minnesota, and am a native Minnesotan. When considering the policies and impacts of regulating sports wagering, it is important to recognize that this would not bring a new activity to the state that Minnesotans have never seen before. Studies estimate that 1.1 million Minnesotans place $2.5 billion in illegal sports wagers annually using offshore sites on their phones and computers right now. These offshore sites do not care whether users placing a bet do so responsibly or whether they are extending themselves beyond a point they are comfortable with. These offshore sites do not use the best available technology to ensure their users aren't underage. And these offshore sites do not pay taxes to or cooperate with the state to assure best practices are carried out diligently. Alternatively, operators in a regulated mobile sports wagering market take public safety and responsible gaming seriously. We want to provide the excitement of feeling a little extra invested in the outcome of a game while instituting the guardrails to do so responsibly. Not only is it just the right thing to do, but in a regulated market, the continued use of our license is conditioned upon our strict adherence to responsible gaming and any other provisions put in place by the state. Before I close, I would like to briefly mention just some of the public safety and responsible gaming benefits that come along with a regulated mobile sports wagering market.
Mr. Gibbs, you're actually at time, so if you can wrap up real quick.
Yep, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I'm available for questions if you have any. Thanks.
All right, thank you. Next on the list, I have Danelle Bratton. If you can introduce yourself, I will try to pronounce your name correctly and go ahead with your testimony.
Hi, thank you. You did well. My name is Danelle Bratton, and I am with a youth group, Neighborhood Youth Academy in Minnesota. And thank you, Madam Chair and the community, for allowing me to be able to speak and testify on my concerns in regards to this bill. I work with young people, and particularly young people that have an opportunity, especially in marginalized communities, to have an opportunity to go to college and get some support. The problem with this bill that I have and what I'm hearing in these conversations is just because it's on the black market and people is already doing it, doesn't mean that we have to legalize the negative because it becomes a behavior disorder. There is already data out there, and we don't have time to go over it, that shows that if we legalize this, especially when it's dealing with the mobile devices, young people already have their mobile devices in their hands most of the time because we see it, and now have the opportunity to take an to actually start sports betting and allowing them to develop a behavior which leads to other things, and there's statistics out there. I really have a problem with this, and the reason why I have a problem with this because of what I'm hearing. Like, think about it. Is a lot of black market with Percocets and narcotics that people are selling on the black market. So just because it's on the black market, do we legalize that? We don't need to legalize this, or especially with young people. I don't hear anything on how we can support people in the urban community. I hear about all the tribal. I'm hearing about different places, but how does it benefit Minnesotans, especially our young people? So I'm totally opposed to this, and it's going to have a grave impact on a community that's already have suffered over the years. So we really need to figure out how we can do this to make sure that our young people don't be affected by this. I wish I had more time, but I'm really passionate about not letting this go through because we need to address how it's going to impact communities of color. Thank you.
Great. Thank you for your testimony. Next on the list, I have Les Bernal. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Hey, good morning. I'm Les Bernal. I'm the National Director for Stop Predatory Gambling. We are based in Washington, D.C. We're a national 501c3. I'm actually coming to you today from Boston, Massachusetts, is where I'm based out of. Stop Predatory Gambling is a national network of citizens of all political stripes, and our mission is to reveal the truth behind commercialized gambling operators to prevent more victims. And so there's several reasons why this committee should vote an enthusiastic no against this bill. And my written testimony that I submitted yesterday focuses on two of those reasons. But before I touch on those two, I'm going to just make you aware of a couple other key aspects about these proposals that are coming before you. One is this false perception that commercialized gambling, sports gambling particularly, is like any other business. What makes it different than other businesses, other vices even, than alcohol and tobacco, is this is it's a big con. You know, commercialized sports gambling is already legal in Minnesota. If you and I want to make a friendly wager on the March Madness bracket, we could already do that. What's illegal in Minnesota is running a sports book, running it as a business, because it's inherently predatory. That's why Minnesota over the years has prohibited this activity, because it's a form of financial fraud. It's a big con. So I think that's what makes this different. If you go order a glass of beer, you know, order a slice of pizza, that's what you get in return. So this is a form, a financial exchange that is rigged against you. The second key reason here is that you hear a lot of lobbyists saying, you know, we want to regulate. Let's look at when they say that when it comes to gambling, commercialized gambling, when lobbyists and public officials talk about regulating, what they're really talking about is its promotion. No one regulates this to protect consumers in Minnesota. Okay. Right now in Minnesota, you go on the Minnesota Lottery website, the state's selling a $50 scratch ticket to the poorest communities of your state. A $50 scratch ticket. That's a government program. You know, 50% of the profits, gambling profits in online gambling, like it's being proposed in Minnesota, comes from people who are addicted to gambling. The business model is based on the addicted gambler. Okay, so and already in Minnesota, the people are losing. If you combine the losses to the lottery and combined to the electronic pull tabs, the people in Minnesota are losing $740 million a year of personal wealth every year, most of which is coming from low-income communities who are disproportionately black and brown folks. So when the gentleman before me is talking about how this impacts people of color, what Minnesota is doing, like other states are doing, we continue to shift the tax burden onto low-income folks at the expense of middle-class and upper-class folks who are disproportionately white. Okay, that's just the reality. So Minnesota's been the epicenter.
But Mr. Bernal, that's time. If you can wrap up real quick.
This is, you know, that last piece on this is you're about to, if you legalize this, you unleash an epidemic of child gambling in Minnesota, because that's what markets in this world, the Lord that have legalized this stuff, that's what's happened. So please take a look at our written testimony and please contact us offside of this hearing for any more information. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And that wraps up our testifiers. We'll move on to committee discussion. First, I've got Representative Scott.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I had some questions for the bill's author. Number one, on page 12, 12.23 to 12.25, this appears to be exempting the tribal entities from being subject to Chapter 13 with these operational agreements. Normally, those folks that have an agreement with any government entity have to abide by Chapter 13 themselves. And just wondering if these operational agreements are going to be public information. So if the bill's author could address that.
Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I appreciate the chance to clarify that this operational agreement, if you look at the language on 12.22 to 12.23, it says executed pursuant to this paragraph. That operational agreement is expected to be an intertribal compact between the tribes, not something that is executed between the tribes and the state or any of the entities. So there is a master license and operational licenses authorized in different paragraphs and different sections of the bill. Those would be not treated this way. The reason for the exemption is because the state isn't a party to this particular operational agreement. It's an intertribal compact is what's contemplated in this particular paragraph.
A follow-up, Representative Scott.
Yeah, Madam Chair. I just think on a situation like this, where we're setting up a program like this, that the best thing that we could do is provide a lot of sunlight. And so I have a real problem with that section of the bill. And Representative Stevenson, if I might, Madam Chair, ask another question.
Yeah, go ahead, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I texted you last night to see if the Commissioner of Public Safety, who is going to be overseeing such a program as this, would be available to for committee this morning. And you said, well, it's too late in the day. I'm like, well, I thought that was not a very good reason for not at least trying to get somebody here to answer these questions, because there's several sections. There's Section 18. There's Section 18 has a lot of references to where the commissioner may impose civil penalties and violations. And then again on page 22, all sorts of penalties and civil penalties that the commissioner is going to be allowed and have the purview to develop. But we don't know what those are. We don't know what the plans are. That's the reason the bill's in our committee, and we can't even hear from the commissioner on how this might unfold. So I'm wondering if Representative Stevenson has a response to that.
Representative Stevenson.
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. And as I mentioned to you last night, Representative Scott, asking me to get a state commissioner to appear by text message at 5:30 p.m., the day before an 8:30 a.m. hearing was not realistic. Our commissioners have busy schedules. I would have been very happy to try and make that happen had you given me more than 12 hours notice that you were looking for that. I am very happy to address any questions that you have directly. I'm very happy to have follow-up. This bill has additional committee stops. I would just note that the bill was referred to this committee a week ago, so we knew it was coming to judiciary. It was noticed for several days. It's not a surprise. The civil penalties that you're discussing about have always been in the bill. So it should not, if the commissioner's presence was required, we certainly could have asked him, but we couldn't do that at 5:30 the night before an 8:30 a.m. hearing. It's just not realistic or respectful at this time.
Additional questions, Representative Scott.
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. Well, Representative Stevenson, this is your bill, and the reason that this bill is in our committee is because of civil penalties. You would have maybe thought, since those were going to be written by the Commissioner of Public Safety that you might have had the forethought to have him come to our committee. But you wrote this bill. What was the policy decision in giving that kind of broad authority to the Commissioner of Public Safety?
Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Scott. And I would also add that the bill was heard in the Public Safety Committee. The policy thought is that this is a significant area of gaming. We want to make sure that the commissioner has the tools necessary to ensure the law is followed. There's both criminal penalties for violating the law in this bill, as well as civil penalties, and I think both are appropriate. We want to give the regulator the tools to get the job done.
Final follow-up, Representative Scott, and then I want to give Representative Russell a chance to ask questions. So, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Representative Stevenson, the legislature is usually the one, you know, usually when a bill comes to this committee, there's no speculation of what the civil penalties are going to be on any given issue. They're laid out in the bill. So I hope that this bill will have to come back to our committee, because I highly encourage you to have some of these penalties laid out in statute so that we can make a more informed decision on what's going to happen if somebody doesn't live according to the rules and laws set forth in what you're trying to do here. So thanks, Madam Chair. I appreciate the time.
Yep. Thank you. And I'm guessing this won't be the last time any of us vote or discuss this bill. Next on the list, I have Representative Grossel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just have a question for the author. Since a couple of the testifiers had some great concerns of addiction and so on, in looking at, Representative Stevenson, you said that you've examined the other states, you've looked at the other states around us, you've done your research and everything. In that research, do you have any stats as far as the effect that it's had, as far as increases in addiction, increases in rehabilitation needs and costs?
Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Russell, you know, as I sit right here, I don't have those statistics at my fingertips. It certainly has been an issue that we have looked at. We had a discussion about this in the Human Services Committee as well when we were talking about the problem gaming numbers. I'd be happy to try and get you some data. I want to stress that this bill takes problem gaming really seriously. We devote 40% of the tax revenue generated by this to problem gaming treatment and education. There are a number of protections in the bill to help people get out of trouble. And I would just repeat that the activity is already occurring in shady websites and offshore websites where there are no consumer protections, nothing to guardrails to prevent people from getting into trouble. And of course, none of the money generated from that goes to problem gaming prevention. So problem gaming is very real. It has real consequences. I'm a prosecutor in my day job. I have run into people who have ruined their lives and done terrible things because of their addiction to gaming. But ignoring it and just simply prohibiting this activity does nothing to solve that problem. If anything, it makes it worse. This bill provides the tools to try and address this problem, which is a serious problem in our community.
And not really relevant to the data or civil penalties provisions, but I appreciate your willingness to go ahead and answer that question, Representative Stevenson. Final follow-up, Representative Grossel.
No, Madam Chair. I just the thought of legalizing something so we have more problems when we've already got problems with it. It just doesn't make any sense. But thank you.
We certainly have plenty of problems. with that, Representative Stevenson, seeing no other hands up, a quick summary so we can move on to the vote.
Well, Madam Chair, to paraphrase a popular song, we've got plenty of problems, but this bill ain't one. I'd ask our members to support it. It's a good bill, and I appreciate the committee's time.
All right. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 778, as amended, be referred to the Tax Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Becker Finn?
Aye.
Mueller?
Aye.
Scott?
No.
Feist?
Aye.
Frazier?
Aye.
Grossel?
No.
Herr?
Aye.
Collins? Representative Collins? Johnson?
No.
Liebling?
Aye.
Long?
Aye.
Mortensen?
No.
Novotny?
Novotny, still no.
Farr?
Farr, aye.
Robbins? Representative Robbins?
No.
Bang?
Aye.
Zhang?
Aye.
That is 10 ayes and 6 nays.
Actually, Michaela, I'm going to change my vote from an aye to abstain.
Okay.
Yeah.
9 ayes and 6 nays.
All right. With that, the motion prevails and the bill is on its way to the Tax Committee. Thank you, Representative Stevenson. Next bill on the agenda is House File 3273, a Representative Hansen bill. I will move House File 3273 be referred to Ways and Means. Representative Hansen, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 3273 relates to the Board of Animal Health and chronic waste and disease and provides for a moratorium. The reason it is here are two sections. One is Subdivision 6. At the beginning of the bill, which provides for the farm survey premises data to be public. And the reason for that is when hunters are out, if there's been incidences of chronic waste and disease on the captive deer facilities. So if you're hunting around that facility, you may not know that there is a captive facility nearby. So having that public provides for that awareness. Secondly, at the end of the bill, you will see that it provides that an owner of farm cervidae is liable for additional costs relating to the escape of such an animal that has chronic waste and disease, including the cost of additional surveillance and capture. Minnesota taxpayers have spent millions of dollars cleaning up the mess of chronic waste and disease. We have evidence of deer hunters actually shooting deer that have out in the wild that have plastic ear tags in them. Now, I don't believe that any deer are evolving with plastic ear tags in them. They're not there from the wild. The paragraph also says that the Attorney General will enforce on behalf of any state agency affected with those costs. So providing for cost recovery for those costs that the public has borne in the past for those who have not been able to maintain their fence is an important liability provision, and that is why it is here, Madam Chair.
All right. I do have one testifier on the list, Tony Quillis. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony, keeping in mind that it's 9:53.
I'm well aware of that, Madam Chair, and there is a Rules Committee coming up, too, at 10 o'clock. But, Madam Chair, my name is Tony Quillis, and I am representing the Minnesota Elk Breeders Association, and Representative Hansen touched on the two concerns that we have for the elk breeders. That premises location data right now is private, and the concern is that making it public is that if anybody has a grievance or is looking to do harm to one of these farms, they now have a roadmap to where they are located. It also only singles out cervid farms and does not include private property where CWD-infected deer would be found or public property where CWD-infected deer are found, Madam Chair. Also, I didn't get a chance in the last committee to thank Representative Hansen for Section 3 and that clarification on the registration and transfer of the titles, and that has been clarified to white-tailed deer, so I wanted to thank him for that. And then the last paragraph that Representative Hansen touched on, I think, is right now there is concurrent authority and co-management, if you will, of the Department of Natural Resources and the Board of Animal Health. Oversight also includes enforcement authority for the Farm Survey Program. This paragraph, I think, creates a confusing situation on how, once the surveillance area is established, which is for 15 miles for 3 years, and involving the Attorney General, I think just creates another layer of complexity on an already confusing situation, Madam Chair. So thank you for the ability and the time to make express my concerns on House File 3273.
All right. Any response, Representative Hansen?
I'm not sure if members are aware, but up in northern Minnesota, the people of Minnesota have had to pay for fencing from a dump site, carcasses dumped on public property. So I believe it's over $250K and counting that the public has had to pay for cleaning up and securing that site. I don't want to do that anymore. I think that that's not the public responsibility.
All right. Any discussion to the bill? All right. Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 3273 be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Becker Finn?
Aye.
Mueller?
Aye.
Scott?
No.
Feist?
Aye.
Frazier?
Aye.
Grossel?
No.
Herr?
Aye.
Collins?
Aye.
Johnson?
No.
Liebling?
Aye.
Long?
Aye.
Mortensen?
No.
Novotny?
Novotny, no.
Barr?
Barr, no.
Robbins?
No.
Bang?
Aye.
Jong?
Aye.
That is 10 ayes and 7 nays.
All right, the motion prevails. The bill is referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Thank you, Representative Hansen. I know it's a busy time of year. With that, members, I'm going to give you 4 minutes back in your day. We did it. Thank you, everybody, for your attention this week. Representative Scott, we'll let you take up a couple more minutes.
No, I'm really short, Madam Chair, if you just have a roadmap for next week, if you know.
Well, it's second deadline. So we're very likely going to be meeting next Tuesday evening as well, sort of similar to what we've done the last couple Tuesdays. I've been trying to give you your Fridays so folks can in rural parts can go home if they want to. And got a lot of requests in from a lot of people, including some of your members as well. So doing our best to move things forward within the committee deadline parameters. So likely will be another Tuesday evening hearing next week. Anything else, Representative Scott?
Nope, that's it. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Yep, and I will make sure my staff is in contact with your staff on the other side as well. So we're, everybody has as much information as we can possibly give them so we can be as efficient as possible next week. All right, with that, it is 9:57 and we are adjourned. Thank you.